Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will shed a light on Down syndrome. Also known as trisomy 21, Down syndrome is a genetic disorder caused by the presence of all or part of a third copy of chromosome 21. It is usually associated with physical growth delays, mild to moderate intellectual disability, and characteristic facial features. Down syndrome varies in severity among individuals, and experts say it is the most common genetic chromosomal disorder and cause of learning disabilities in children. The genetic mutation that causes Down syndrome increases the risk of intellectual disabilities and an early death from autoimmune diseases and pneumonia. But it also protects from some cancers, and it often leads to people valued for their kindness and joy. Recently, researchers discovered a major clue as to why the genetic disorder does these things. The mutation increases inflammation. Shelley Schlender explains how this knowledge may lead to healthier lives for those with Down syndrome.
At the Linda Cernick Institute for Down Syndrome in Colorado, researcher Kate Waugh counts the many ways she adores her husband's brother, who has Down syndrome.
He always wants to marry my sisters. He really likes to color. He loves to sing. He brings a lot of joy.
People with Down syndrome have a lower risk for some cancers. As for why, Cernick Institute research shows that they have hyperactive immune systems.
Superman cells in some ways. They're revved up ready to go like gangbusters compared to you and I.
But supercharged can also mean super out of balance, leading to disorders such as alopecia areata, a form of hair loss, and a stressed immune system can get exhausted. That's risky in seasons of flu or COVID-19.
People with Down syndrome are really predisposed to having severe pneumonia. My brother-in-law, who's in his mid-30s, that's actually the scariest part of the year.
The scientists want to reduce those risks.
The mission of the Cernick Institute is to improve the lives of all people with Down syndrome through biomedical research.
Institute Director Joaquin Espinosa has many buddies with Down syndrome. They include TV star Megan Baumgars from the Emmy-winning series Born This Way about Down syndrome.
He's running the show because he's a star right here.
Oh, sorry. The person who won an Emmy is not me.
I think it could be multiple Emmys.
Baumgars' autoimmune disorders include celiac disease. It's no problem when she avoids foods that contain gluten, like wheat. That's not always easy.
My teacher told me I had a bad behavior problem because I had their school food, and they're not gluten-free food. So that's why my mom came back and told my teachers, I don't have a behavior problem. It's the school food that gets me sick.
For you to know that you had celiac disease, it changed your life. It had all kinds of benefits. So we need to come up with quick, effective ways of diagnosing these conditions that are more common in people with Down syndrome.
Espinosa's teams are also investigating how lifestyle and drugs might rebalance the immune system.
People with Down syndrome are up here, and typical people are down here. Bring people with Down syndrome closer to the normal range.
What they discover may help anyone with afflictions that range from cancer and dementia to pneumonia. For VOA News, Shelley Schlender, Denver, Colorado.
For more on Down syndrome, I spoke with Michelle C. Wheaton, co-founder and executive director of the Global Down Syndrome Foundation. Take a listen.
Michelle C. Wheaton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you help us understand what Down syndrome is? How would you kind of summarize it for us?
Well, Down syndrome is a chromosomal condition where a person is born with three copies of chromosome 21 instead of two. And because of that, there are certain character traits that people with Down syndrome have, but it's like typical people, there's a big spectrum of ability, there's a big spectrum of character traits, and generally you're going to be more like your family and your genetics of your family than another person with Down syndrome.
So there is a genetic link to it. Can you explain the cause or causes of Down syndrome and the genetic link?
Yes, I think that the triplication of chromosome 21 is not well understood. So why that happens, we're not completely sure, except that we know like in 1 or 2% of people, it is hereditary, where one of the parents accidentally passes on that extra chromosome that might be sticking off of their own chromosome. And then for the majority, like 98%, 97%, something happens, you know, during cell division that's not accurate, and the child is born with three copies instead of two. Now, we also know that as you get older, the chances of you kind of misfiring, you know, in terms of that cell division is greater than when you're younger. So people often talk about in the US, 35 and older, the risk is higher. Having said that, there are more people under 35 having babies with Down syndrome because there are just more people under 35 having babies in general.
What is to be expected when someone has Down syndrome, when a child has Down syndrome? What are the early signs?
Yes. Well, I think that in terms of the physical character traits, there are some characteristics like being shorter in stature, right? Having a smaller bridge, a flatter nose, you know, having almond-shaped eyes, maybe having like what I have, like that crease here that goes all the way across your hand. So all of these character traits can be found in typical people that don't have Down syndrome, but as a group, you know, they're identified. But what I want to say is that they looked a lot alike when they were institutionalized and they weren't given an opportunity to have medical care, physical activity, you know, even love, education. And that did that stunts your growth, whether you're typical or you have Down syndrome. And so the categorization in the early days in the United States, unfortunately, until the 1990s, the early 1990s, most of our people with Down syndrome were institutionalized. What we find is that given a proper environment, you have thin people, you have tall people, you have people who are overweight, you have people who are blonde, you have people who are brunette, you have people with big eyes, small eyes, you know. So, I mean, really, there is something about the character traits that can be identified as Down syndrome. But within that, you know, you have all sorts of sizes and shapes and also abilities in terms of cognition, sports, athleticism, music ability. We talk about the multiple intelligences, not just IQ, you know, being kinesthetic, being musically intelligent, being athletic. You know, there are a lot of different kinds of intelligences, and people with Down syndrome have many different intelligences, just like typical people.
That's interesting that you say that, because a lot of time people think that disability means inability, and it's good to hear that you know, they are very, because they are very much active and they can do so many different things. So what are some of the early interventions that have proven effective or helpful?
Well, I think first and foremost, having them in their home, going to a school that typical people go to and having that opportunity is number one, right? What we find in countries or even towns or cities that don't do that, we find that the people with Down syndrome and frankly, the typical people don't learn as well or do as well. So having that opportunity. The other thing is that the medical care, when our people were institutionalized in the United States, which wasn't that long ago, they had no access to medical care. In fact, it was inhumane how they were treated. So having access to good medical care will make a huge difference. And one big thing, you know, the average lifespan was 27 years old in the 1980s. Today it's 60. In part, it's because access to medical care and also heart surgeries. There are 50% of people with Down syndrome born with congenital heart conditions. A lot of them are small, little repairs. Some of them are open heart surgery. My daughter had open heart surgery. So that advancement has certainly elongated life. In terms of the earlier intervention from 0 to 3, having that physical therapy, having the speech therapy, having the occupational therapy makes a huge difference. Even how they, what kind of bottle or sippy cup they use will, for example, inhibit or make worse tongue protrusion, right? And tongue protrusion is something that is kind of stigmatized and makes it harder for you to be accepted in society. So why not do that early intervention that helps with that. And it also helps with language and communication.
So in a general sense, what are some of the common challenges that they face?
Well, I think the biggest challenge that they face is discrimination, the low expectation, the lack of resources. And then, of course, every time, like, if you read the literature, it's like, oh my gosh, a person with Down syndrome read at the second grade level. Oh my gosh, a person with Down syndrome reads at the fourth grade level. Of course, now there are people with Down syndrome who are reading at the eighth grade level, at the high school level, and there are people even with Down syndrome graduating with a college degree. So there's a huge spectrum of ability, just like in the typical population. And I think discrimination and low expectations is the biggest enemy for people with Down syndrome and progress. The second biggest enemy is really the health. A lot of what the health issues are in the typical population. We know how to treat it. So if up to 70% of people have sleep apnea that have Down syndrome, and they're not breathing at night, and they're not sleeping, and they're oxygen deprived, how are they going to do in school? How is their health going to be? What is their attention span? So a lot of times dealing with the medical issue unlocks that child or adult with Down syndrome's ability to learn and to be functional. So I would say the discrimination being number one, and then the medical care really being number two, that's a big obstacle. And then of course, really then the other big obstacle that they have is the aging. You know, there are some co-occurrence of disease. On the one hand, a lot of them will get Alzheimer's. How do we deal with that? On the other hand, it's almost impossible for a person with Down syndrome to get a solid tumor cancer.
So you mentioned earlier some of the intervention.
Oh, yeah, I think if you have speech and communication early on, and especially they need to model typical people. They need to be here, just like a typical baby. If you're not speaking in that family, you know, they're not going to be accessing speech, right? So hearing that typical language and communication is very important, modeling that. You know, we have people with Down syndrome who have spoken on TED Talks, you know. So again, I think everybody has their own potential and their own genetic makeup from their family that kind of predisposes you to where you're going to be at. But within the Down syndrome community, just like the typical, you know, you have people off the charts doing amazing things. And I would say most of them have had early intervention where either a teacher or a speech language pathologist has worked with them on communication and speech, right? Just like in the typical population, that one teacher can make a huge difference for the whole trajectory of that person's life. I believe in you. I'm going to make sure you learn this. I'm going to meet you where you're at and do it in chunks and bites. And that's the other thing. Our kiddos tend to need more repetition and, you know, chunking things up, you know, like you access this, then we move on to this, right? We access this, then we move on to that. It's not rocket science, really. It's just good teaching and good therapy.
And Michelle, you mentioned discrimination. This is a serious problem everywhere in the world, whether it's in low and middle income countries or even in developed countries. So what message do you have for parents who have to deal with that, and also for the communities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, we all have to stand up to discrimination. You know, first and foremost, for our own families, you know, and we have to teach the person with Down syndrome, and this is tough, to stand up for themselves, right? That is so important. Never for us, without us, right? The person with Down syndrome has to learn how to do things independently, and that's scary for a parent, right? You know, because you're afraid, will they get hurt? Will they get abused? Will they get, of course, within your framework of risk, we want safety for that child. We don't want that child to get, you know, more abused or physically hurt by standing up for themselves. But there are ways in which you can teach any child or any adult to stick up for themselves. So I think that's the message. Teach them to say no when they mean no in a way that's respectful but clear. Teach them to, if they're able to really communicate well, to say who they are and what they believe in and have an opinion. So all those things are really important. And every parent I know has had to advocate at the school level, at the work level, and certainly on occasion, you know, even with neighbors and friends on occasion, and treat that as a teaching opportunity, right? And not as a, I'm offended, you're horrible. Before we had children with Down syndrome, we didn't know what that was like. And we didn't know what was politically correct or offensive or hurtful. But now that we know that, we use these points of discrimination as a teaching moment or a learning moment.
Great. And talk to us about the Global Down Syndrome Foundation, the mission of your organization, and what sorts of intervention or program have you seen, have you implemented that has bred results?
So we focus on research and medical care. And what a lot of people don't realize is that without research, we don't have the medical care. So we have to do the research, even basic informational research, like natural history research. Like if you have sleep apnea, did you also have an infantile seizure when you were a baby? Like, you know, and what does that mean for your medical outcome? Who's getting Alzheimer's? Who's not? What is going on within that Down syndrome population is very important. And so our research, we had one of the biggest breakthroughs probably in 20 years, and it basically allows us to categorize Down syndrome as an immune system disorder. So what we found was that there's this immune system pathway called the interferon pathway. In you and me, typical people, it turns on when we fight an infection and virus, and then it turns off. But in people with Down syndrome, it's on 24/7 all the time. So that taxation of the immune system could explain inflammation of the brain and kind of cognition disorders. It could explain why they don't get solid tumor cancers. It could explain why 70% have autoimmune disorders, right? And so now the science is galvanized by this finding, and there is a lot of great things coming out of it. And we're actually doing a clinical trial, first a safety trial to try and cure autoimmune disease in people with Down syndrome. So that's really exciting. And we found with one of the, not to get too technical, there's a medicine that brings down interferon, that the alopecia areata, where you get just tufts of hair, and then there's this boils where you kind of get these horrible boils in your underarms and below your knees. Anyway, a lot of people with Down syndrome have those. It's actually already shown that this drug is curing those things, these ailments that a lot of people with Down syndrome have. So so that's exciting. And then we're serving 1,800 plus pediatric care patients and about 400 adult patients. And we are about this year, we're going to publish the first ever medical care guidelines for adults with Down syndrome. They simply don't exist in kind of a current evidence-based methodology. And that will just have a huge legacy, because any clinician, of course, at first in English, but we're going to translate it into like 10 different languages. Clinicians all over the world will be able to look at this and say, wow, what do I need to be looking for when I treat an adult patient with Down syndrome?
Michelle C. Wheaton, it was great speaking with you, and we appreciate you enlightening us on Down syndrome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for everything you do for the world.
That was Michelle C. Wheaton, co-founder and executive director of the Global Down Syndrome Foundation. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Prominent Washington journalists as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week. Issues in the News moderator Shayna Estulin and a panel of experts will analyze the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we can all help fight the corona pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and nose when we are in crowded places or areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Let's go to Kenya, where residents of a Mombasa slum won a landmark payout in July over pollution by a lead smelter that poisoned locals. Kenya's government was ordered to pay $12 million to residents within 90 days because of its failure to enforce environmental regulations with the smelter, which closed in 2014. But the government has appealed the payout, as Lenny Ruvaga reports from Mombasa, Kenya.
Authorities shut down the lead smelter run by Kenya Metal Refineries EPZ Limited in 2014 due to severe pollution and after several deaths that locals blamed on lead poisoning. But it wasn't until this past July that an environmental and land court awarded the residents of Mombasa's Owino Uhuru slum a $12 million payout. It was the first time the Kenyan government was ordered to compensate victims for failing to stop pollution, setting a precedent for future claims. The celebration, however, was short-lived, as Kenya's Attorney General's office said it was dissatisfied with the decision and planned to appeal. Anastasia Nambu, a resident at the informal settlement, says the appeal has dashed their hopes for an early settlement. She says the government has shown that it does not value the residents of the settlement. People in the community are still suffering as a result, but the government has disregarded all this. Nambu says if the government was concerned about their welfare, they would have settled the claim, but instead they are abusing the court process through their appeal. 48-year-old Nambu, a mother of four, says the pollution gave her constant migraines and body aches, and she can no longer afford her pain medication. Nambu says her entire family has been affected. They were all tested and found to have been poisoned by the emissions from the lead factory. She says her children's memories were affected, leading to poor performance in school, and they also complain of joint aches and migraines every day. Smoke from the smelter discolored rooftops, and a 2015 report by lawmakers said water in the area was contaminated by lead. The court in July also ordered Kenya's National Environmental Management Authority to clean up remaining pollution. But the government's appeal has put that cleanup effort in doubt. Kenya activist group Center for Justice, Governance and Environmental Action helped locals with suing the government. Tom Ooko is the program's officer at CJGEA. He spoke to VOA about the case.
It's been like a decade of suffering for these people. When they continue prolonging this, more people will continue to suffer and more will die. It also means that there is no closure for the families that lost their loved ones, and also there's no health and continuity of safe, sustainable life in this community is at risk.
The Attorney General's office declined to comment on the appeal, and requests for comment from the National Environmental Management Authority went unanswered. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Mombasa, Kenya.
Botswana extended a COVID-19 state of emergency by 6 months Monday night, despite objections from opposition parties. The extension means President Mokgweetsi Masisi will continue to rule by decree until March 2021, a full year since the pandemic hit Africa. But opposition members in Botswana voted against the extension, arguing it gives the president too much power and stifles economic recovery. Mkondisi Dube reports from Gaborone.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi, in his address to a special session of parliament, said it was necessary to extend the state of emergency, which came into effect in March.
The disease burden has made it clear and imperative for us to extend the state of public emergency in the interest of the public. In this context, I will request Parliament, through a motion, to extend the state of public emergency by a period of 6 months.
Botswana has seen a steady rise in cases since registering its first in March. The country currently has more than 3,170 cases, with 16 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the pandemic. President Masisi added the state of emergency will be used solely for the purpose of fighting the infection.
It is my considered view, though, that the extension of the state of public emergency provides a better option to safeguard the lives of Botswana while containing and controlling the disease.
Among others, President Masisi said the state of emergency would ensure workers are protected against retrenchment and maintain the restrictions on the movement of people in and out of the country. He said the country's Public Health Act was inadequate to fully equip his government to fight the pandemic. Opposition parties said they were not convinced an extension of the state of emergency was necessary. David Tere of the opposition coalition Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, argued against the move.
This is not acceptable. We are restricting movement of people in and outside the country. South Africa has opened up the borders. Namibia has opened up the borders. And we have a treaty with these countries. So you are saying we should continue to close, while others, your neighbors, Your Excellency, have opened.
The leader of the opposition parliament, Dumelang Salisando, warned the economy will suffer as a result of the extended restrictions.
We are closing down the economy. They need certainty. Households are not going to survive this.
Despite the opposition members' objections, the ruling party's majority in the National Assembly meant the extension was approved. The country's economy is expected to contract by around 9% this year. Its backbone, the diamond industry, suffered significantly after international buyers were shut out due to travel restrictions. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
And that's it for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guest, Michelle C. Wheaton, co-founder and executive director of the Global Down Syndrome Foundation. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou, in Washington with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently and strive to make every day a healthy day. In the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa. This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
During this pandemic, the World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say if you have a fever, a cough, or have trouble breathing, you should stay at home and contact a healthcare facility. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest health news.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.